Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Turul Mende, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Emily Dromster about her new book, Ways of Seeking, the Arabic Novel and the Poetics of Investigation. Welcome to the podcast, Emily.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maybe we can start a bit about that. You tell us about yourself, how you started to work on the book and where you are right now, basically.
Yeah, so I'm currently an assistant professor at the University of Texas at Austin. I started here in 2021 after 5 years teaching at Brown University. And this book actually began as my doctoral dissertation. So I started work on it in about 2012. So it's been 12 whole years to get to this point. And it took a finished form as the dissertation, and it has evolved all the way until I submitted the revised manuscript to the publisher last year. So it took about 11 years? Yeah, for it to take this final form. But it had a final-ish form as the dissertation, but the book is really very different from the dissertation. So yeah, and that's sort of the book. And then for me, I'm just an Arabic professor, Arabic scholar, and still an Arabic student. So as I tell my Arabic students, I'm still a student of the language, not necessarily an expert.
Thank you so much, Emily. And so you started working on the book basically as a PhD dissertation. And is it much different from your dissertation, or how did it evolve after your dissertation was completed, and how did it evolve into this book form?
Yeah, so when it was a dissertation, it was called Chronicles of Disappearance, and then it had a subtitle that I'm not fully remembering, the Arabic novel, and something about disappearance. But the dissertation was really a historical argument. So I was interested in post-1967 Arabic fiction. So in Arabic literary studies, we tend to sort of divide the aesthetics of the novel by different eras. And the eras are often based on political events. So say, you know, post-1948 Palestinian fiction, that tells you that the Nakba is sort of the central paradigm there. For post-67 fiction, the sort of truism in the field is that this is a period of defeat and feeling run down, and it also leads to experimentation and disillusionment with older forms. So when I was writing the dissertation, I sort of internalized what the field of Arabic literary studies said about 67 fiction. And I said, okay, this the phenomenon of disappearance or seeking or questing after some absent figure is part of the disillusionment of post-1967 fiction. And I selected novels only that were only published after 1967. And I sort of said, like, this is a genre, this novel of disappearance is a genre particular to this historical period. Upon finishing the PhD, starting my job, I started to read more widely, and I discovered that what I had argued, you know, this sort of like questing after an absent figure or a mystery, like trying to solve a mystery, this was not only a paradigm from post-1967, this existed across Arabic fictions from multiple periods that we tend to consider as discrete in the field. So the book is actually trying to work against some of the periodization that tends to get done in Arabic literary studies. So I'm purposely pairing, for example, Yusuf al-Qa'id, who's an Egyptian author from the 1970s, with Yusuf Idris, who, you know, a novel by Yusuf Idris from 1959, which is, of course, pre-67, right? To say, like, look, these novels are doing really similar things, even though 1967 supposedly represents this rupture. So that's really the transformation from dissertation to book, is whereas the diss was making a historical argument about, like, okay, this literary form is common to this period, the book is sort of saying, actually, this literary form has different branches that manifest in different periods, and there's commonalities between different novels that we might not have expected. So that's the main difference, is the extending that historical scope and changing the patterns that I was paying close attention to.
Thank you so much. And before diving into more the content and the structure of the book, can you explain to us what you mean by the title about this current book, Ways of Seeking, and the Poetics of Investigation? What can you elaborate on that, this a bit, maybe?
Yes, of course. Yeah. So Ways of Seeking is a reference to John Berger, who is a British art historian and scholar. He has a classic book and series of videos called Ways of Seeing, which are about the, you know, they're about power and how power manifests in European art forms, especially. It's a great series of videos talking about feminism and oil painting and very materialist approach to art history. So I'm referencing him, and there's sort of a theoretical genealogy that I'm engaging with in, especially in the book's introduction, which includes texts like Ways of Seeing by Berger, but also Michel Foucault's Discipline and Punish, Edward Said's Orientalism, Timothy Mitchell's Colonizing Egypt. All of these theoretical works have a sort of paradigm where they argue that whether it be colonialism in the case of Mitchell and Said, or you know, the liberal state in the case of Foucault's Discipline and Punish, it's the sort of variations on the panopticon. So this idea that there's a viewer, that space can be arranged to create distance between a subject of viewing and things around that subject that are rendered up as objects for the consumption or exploitation of the subject viewer. So, you know, for Foucault, this is the panopticon that transforms all subjects of the liberal state into self-disciplining subjects because they fear that they are watched by that central tower. For Mitchell, it is the figure of the viewer at the European World Exhibition. So he calls it the world as exhibition. And of course, that is a variation on Martin Heidegger's world as picture. So sorry, I'm getting a little bit into the weeds here. But so I see across Middle East studies and also across comparative literature, which are really my two fields, variations on this theory of here is how a subject is created, and in the process of creating a subject, everything else around that subject is rendered up as an object. So a lot from Said on down to Mitchell and all these other people, a lot of Middle East studies has been dedicated to critiquing that process through the colonial archive, but not necessarily through culture and fiction. So what I was looking for is ways of seeking after truth and knowledge and power that messed with that paradigm of subject creation, if that makes sense. So the paradigmatic one is the one that I open the book with, which is Amina, the matriarch of the family in Naguib Mahfouz's trilogy, is this mother figure is standing on the roof of her house in Islamic Cairo, looking out on the world. But the relationship, so technically she is in the panoramic or panoptic position, right? She is on the roof looking out over the city, and could, you know, theoretically could see all and sort of know all, and the city could be the object of her subject gaze. But the way Mahfouz describes that scene is very self-effacing, because she's a pious Muslim subject. And so she sees the entire world as a series of interconnected forces. There's not so much this division between I am the subject who sees all and controls all, and this is all the object of my domain, but rather everything, you know, chicken, she keeps chickens, she has some jasmine vines, and he describes how this whole world is sort of all part of divine creation. So that scene is just one of many scenes of seeking that I gather from Arabic fictions in this book. And so when I say ways of seeking, it's really just supposed to be what are the ways of seeking after and producing knowledge chronicled in Arabic fictions that can be useful to scholars of the Middle East and scholars not only of fiction, but of history, society, economy, all of these other things. So how can we turn narrative structures into methodological approaches that are less coercive than, say, Orientalism and other paradigms? Yeah.
Thank you so much, Emily. And looking at the novels that you work on in the book, the detective genre is quite a huge part of it. Mm-hmm. And can you describe how this genre developed in recent times, and why did you wanted to focus on this genre in particular?
Yes, so I wanted to focus on detective fiction because it is sort of the epistemological genre par excellence. So it's every detective novel is about knowledge and its production and its use and how it's created and who holds it and what they do with knowledge. I quote Peter Brooks, who is a scholar of you know, an American scholar of fiction and psychoanalysis. I have the quote here just because it's so important to my thinking in the book. So he calls detective fiction, quote, the narrative of narratives. Its classical structure is a laying bare of the structure of all narrative, in which what is at stake is a gain in knowledge, a self-conscious creation of meaning. So Peter Brooks is one figure, Svetlana Todorov, the French formalist theorist, is another figure. What I like about detective fiction is that it dramatizes how all fiction works, because what you have is this distinction between the crime, so what actually happened, and how the crime is sort of pieced together and put together, which is how the crime is narrated. And that's how all narrative fiction works, right? You have what actually happened, which is the what, but then you have how the story is told, which is the how. So who is the narrator? From what perspective? Which pieces of information get relayed to us at what times? What does the narrator withhold? Is it a first-person narrator? Is it an omniscient narrator? What does omniscience mean? You know, so I like that detective fiction sort of gives us a structure or a model for thinking about all storytelling and all fiction. And also, I think as readers, we take for granted the truth the truth value of what's presented to us. But as critical readers, we have to sort of dig into that and say, like, why, you know, like, why does Mahfouz, for example, in that scene that I was just describing, zoom in on Amina's consciousness at that point in the narrative? And whose consciousness does he break to in the next chapter, right? Just thinking about those juxtapositions is important. So I think I was drawn to detective fiction for the same reasons as people like Peter Brooks and Todorov were in the Western context, but I wanted to bring that critical thinking a little bit more to Arabic fiction, because it's all about knowledge and you know, epistemology and who has knowledge and to what purpose is it used. And the other thing, the other reason I was drawn to it is because many scholars, this is sort of a phenomenon from the 1980s, but many scholars of Western literature and British literature in particular see detective fiction as a form that disciplines its readers into becoming obedient subjects of the liberal state, right? So, you know, police fiction sort of trains you to view yourself as always policed, and thus you, this is D.A. Miller's argument in the novel and the police. And there are many variations on that argument through the scholarship on Western detective fiction in the 80s. I wanted to see, how do Arab authors receive and sort of mess with that paradigm? Are detective fictions always this sort of disciplining genre, or is there a way that they dramatize knowledge that can challenge that model? And so the texts that I've gathered, they dramatize the production and use of knowledge by official bodies on the one hand and by unofficial and popular figures on the other. So there's often a sort of contrast or dialogue between, you know, the police officer, the state investigator, the representative of the state, also academics, psychoanalysts, anyone who produces official knowledge. And then there are unofficial popular figures. So the quasi-mad Sufi sheikh is a recurring figure in a lot of the Egyptian fictions that I looked at, or the mystical, you know, Christ-like figure is important for Jabra Ibrahim Jabra in Search of Walid Mas'ud, which is another novel that I worked. The pious Muslim woman, the everyday Egyptian, there's all of these figures who produce knowledge of a different kind that kind of challenges the official knowledge production of a police officer or an academic. And so, so those are the various ways that I was drawn to detective fictions, because it's about knowledge, and it's about the production of knowledge and the use of knowledge. And, but it also, you know, questions, who we allow to produce the knowledge that we accept as true and who could potentially, you know, wedge their way into that. I should also say, just to clarify, and this is a little bit back to your previous question, but so the poetics of investigation is also playing with an Arabic word for seeking, which is bahith. And I was drawn to this term because it has so many, it's so polyvalent. It has so many different meanings. So a bahath can be an official investigation. It could be a police investigation. It could be, it's the word we use for dissertation, like an academic dissertation, a bahath. It's also like al-mabahath are like the secret police of state, you know, like of totalitarian states. So it has this resonance as official knowledge, but it also, a bahath is, can be also open-ended and sort of a mystical quest for gnosis or more, you know, like more spiritual knowledge and less police-like knowledge. And so my part of the argument of the book is that Arab authors either directly or indirectly play on that multivalence. So they'll have one great example is Naguib Mahfouz's Culprit Unknown. That's my translation of a short story called Did Majhul or Did Maghul, where It's the main character is a police officer who's investigating a series of mysterious crimes, but he just so happens to be a fan of Sufi texts and Sufi poetry. So there's a series of these mysterious murders. He can't find the connection. He doesn't know who the murderer is. He's looking everywhere. He sent everybody out. He's looking at the crime scenes. He can't put it together. So when he feels utterly defeated, what does he turn to but Sufi poetry? Because there he finds the kind of oneness, and he can release that need to create one kind of knowledge and embrace a different kind of knowledge that comes to him from letting go of the self, basically. So yeah, that's just going back to what I mean by poetics of investigation, is like playing on Bahith as both official and unofficial knowledge.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
And the novels that you are looking at in your book, how widely read were these novels? Can you tell us a bit about, were they like popular among the general readers, or were they like mostly read by specialists? So can you tell us about the readership a little bit?
Yes. So I don't really write that much about the who read these novels. I think they are not popular. So this is definitely not the popular fiction that you would associate with detective fiction. On popular fiction, and like sort of more classic detective fiction, I highly recommend Samah Saleem's book, Popular Fictions and the Nahda. And Elliot Kola has also written a long article about popular sort of, I don't want to say, it's not so much detective fiction, but it's popular memoirs in the same period of the Nahda. So this is not the it's not so much the popular fictions of detective fiction, but more how were canonical Arab authors, sort of like quote unquote high literary authors, reading detective fiction and using those types of structures to create their own novels. I write about Yusuf Idris's The Sinners, Al Haram, Yusuf Al-Qaid's Yahdath fi Masr Al-An, which is it's happening now in Egypt, and then a bunch of Mahfuz texts, including the trilogy, so the Bain al-Qasrain, the Cairo trilogy, as well as a lot of his short novellas from the 1960s. At-Tariq is one, which has been translated as The Search, but really means The Path. Za'balawi is another, and the Dmakul, Culprit Unknown, which I translated a couple summers ago. Although I did not do the sort of sociological research to investigate like how many people read each of these books, my suspicion is that not a lot of people read them, with the exception of Mahfouz after he won the Nobel Prize, right? Then sort of like a lot more people read his texts. But like, you know, Yusuf Al-Qaid's novel, Yahdath fi Misr Al-An, he wrote it in 1973-74. He couldn't publish it in Egypt at that time, so he self-published it, and it wasn't actually, and then he published it elsewhere, once in Haifa, I think maybe in Lebanon, and then it wasn't published in Egypt again, besides that self-publishing, until 1981 or 82. So I suspect that wasn't very well widely read, right? And it's kind of a crazy experimental novel. Jabr Ibrahim Jabra is a sort of self-professed, you know, high intellectual. So his Al-Bahth an Walid Mas'ud, I think, was widely read, but among more of a literary public than a popular public, if that makes sense. So this is all my suspicion. I don't have data to sort of back this up, but that's my suspicion based on what I know of publishing in the Arab world.
Yes, thank you so much. And in the chapters that you are worked on, you look at different authors as well. And how are these chapters connected with each other, or can they be read separately from each other?
Yeah, so I think you could read them separately from each other. So, for example, the last chapter is about the Egyptian author Sanalla Ibrahim. And the argument there does sort of stand on its own about Sanalla Ibrahim, but it's that chapter is linked. Basically, all the chapters are linked as different subgenres of detect. Each chapter is a sort of Arab take on a sub, or Arabic take on a subgenre of detective fiction. So, you know, so chapter one is about Tawfiq al-Hakim and Driss Shraibi, who's a Francophone Moroccan author. I do have one Francophone text in this book. But, you know, my argument is that al-Hakim and Shraibi are playing on the classic detective fiction. So this would be stuff like Sherlock Holmes and Agatha Christie, like that type, that type of classic detective fiction where you have, you know, the detective who's putting the pieces together. And then chapter two is about Yusuf Al-Qaid and Yusuf Idris, which I'm sort of playing off their work as what's called sensation fiction in Victorian British literary studies. I'm not saying that they are, you know, just like following the British model, but that they are using fiction to try to create scandal among their readers, or to not so much to create scandal, but to expose the scandalousness of poverty on the Egyptian Izba, and try to sort of rouse their public into taking action on behalf of the marginalized farm workers and migrant laborers who work in these spaces. So that chapter is like, I use the idea of sensation fiction and apply it and like bring that to the conversation about those authors. The next two chapters deal with what's been theorized as metaphysical detective fiction. So this is where seeking is not so much looking for the killer behind a particular crime, but rather it's a quest in which the detective becomes a subject who sort of mystically loses himself in all of the details and facts that he's accumulating. And looking after truth causes the subject to question the limits and the boundaries and bounds that create him as a subject. And this is often figured, especially in Jabra and Mahfouz, as the quest for an absent person. So in Jabra, that's Walid Mas'ud, who, you know, is kind of transformed into this, he's whatever you want him to be. Like each of the different seekers transforms him into the object. For Mahfouz, especially in the trilogy, it's I sort of show how Kamel, the trilogy's protagonist, is initially structures his life around the presence-absence of Al-Husayn ibn Ali, the Islamic saint whose tomb is in Old Cairo, where Kamel grows up and where Mahfouz himself also grew up. And through his schooling, Kamel eventually learns that Hussein's head, his, you know, like, okay, so the story of Hussein, do our listeners know the story of Hussein, the martyr?
Probably, maybe you can explain it.
Okay. I mean, this is where I might miss my knowledge a little bit, but yes, Hussein is famously martyred in the Battle of Karbala, and the story of the tomb of his tomb in Cairo, which is like the center of the bustling neighborhood named for Al-Hussein. But the story is that, you know, his decapitated head miraculously flew from Karbala all the way to Cairo, where it landed at the site where his shrine now is. Okay, so that's the story that the protagonist of the trilogy has internalized. And when he goes to school, his history teacher disabuses him of this notion and says, you know, like, that's a funny story, but his head is not actually in there. And that throws Kamel completely for a loop, because his whole being, you know, and Mahfouz describes what I think is, I think it offers us one of the best descriptions of Islamic piety and what it means to be pious through this like unseen, but like deeply, deeply heartfelt connection between Kamel and Hussein, and losing that connection through a gain in knowledge, right? Like the secular knowledge that like, no, this head is not here, completely unanchors his subject. So he needs another object to sort of fixate upon and transform into that mysterious truth. So who does he fixate upon but an upper class European style rich girl, basically a French Francophilic rich girl from La Bassia, which is a upper class neighborhood at the time. And he transforms her into what he calls his ma'buda, which in the English translation gets translated as his beloved, which is a fine translation, but ma'buda implies also worship, right? So you would have an abid who is the worshiper, and the ma'buda is the object of worship. So it's not only his beloved, it's his object of worship. And we also know that an abd in Islam is a worshiper of God, right? So she is kind of a godly object. And of course, she is a jerk to him the whole time. Like, she doesn't want to be an object of worship, but he has these long monologues. Anyway, why am I going into all of this? Metaphysical detective fiction, right? So so when I say metaphysical, in the Western scholarship on metaphysical detective fiction, it's often not spelled out that we're talking about the divine. In the Arabic texts that I gather, the divine, especially in Mahfouz, is present in much more sort of like legible ways. So I assembled these chapters to illustrate Arab rewritings and reconfigurations of some of the subgenres of detective fiction that have been established in theory and criticism.
Thank you so much, Emily. And while working on the novels and doing translations for the book, what difficulties did you come across while translating them for your research? Do you have anything particular in mind where you said this would be specifically difficult to translate? Or, yes, can you tell us a bit about this process?
Yeah. I'll give you a couple. There's so many things I could say. I'll give you a couple of exam. I'm just trying to. I wrote them all in my notes for you, and now I'm trying to think of the best examples to give. So, one story that I can tell you is, let me talk about Mahfouz and what I encountered when I went back to Mahfouz. So, I wrote a draft of my third chapter about Mahfouz, where the argument was basically, between writing the trilogy and writing his novellas of the 1960s, Mahfouz experiences a sort of transformation in his poetics. He actually spent a chunk of time between writing his other novels and these novellas, right, as a film, a writer for film. So the argument was, okay, the trilogy is different from these later novellas, because the later novellas are much more what I call Sufi noir. So it's this noir style questing after a dark and mysterious figure, but that dark and mysterious figure has a kind of shifting Sufi saint-like quality. So that's Zabalawi. It's also Culprit Unknown. It's also Atori, right? In Atori, the narrator is searching for his father, which, you know, is a pretty explicit parallel to godliness. But then I went back to, so I was rewriting this chapter, revising it after the peer reviews, and I went back to the trilogy. And I looked at a few of the passages that I had just accepted the English translation And I realized that Kamel is a seeker, that the protagonist is a Sufi type seeker in much the same way as Sabir in Athari, in all of these seekers from the later 60s. So I had been arguing that there was this rupture, and I realized through returning to the trilogy that there's so much Sufi lexicon in the trilogy that I didn't really realize. Abuda is a good example. So he's the Abd and his beloved is the Abuda. At a certain point, Kamel says, he confesses his love to, after many, like hundreds of pages of pining in internal monologue for her, he eventually confesses his love to her. And she's like, okay, well, what are we going to do now? And she's like, are you proposing marriage to me? And he's utterly taken aback by that. He's like, marriage is too worldly, right? Too worldly of a thing. So in his mind, he thinks, and I think the English translation is, what he wanted was communion, or what he wanted was, I don't remember the word they use in English, but when I went back to the Arabic, I discovered that what he says, what he wanted was wisal, which wisal is a key term from Sufism for this sort of like link with the divine beloved oneness, right? So that's just, and then once I found some of these terms from the Sufi lexicon in some pieces of the trilogy, I started to be like, I missed a whole thing here. So I actually went back and reread all those hundreds of pages of the trilogy in Arabic just to make sure that it completely changed my argument. So that's one example. I'm not saying that the published translation is bad. You just don't get that flavor of Sufi polyvalence that Mahfouz is constantly playing with. Wujud is another term that he plays with that's important to someone like Ibn Arabi, but it gets translated so many different ways in English that you don't pick it up unless you go back. So that could be the one thing to say. Can I also say, just PSA for anyone who decides to listen to this, that the search, the translation, English translation of Ettori, which is the search, is terrible. And we need to get a new one. And I'm like going to do it after tenure because I think what happened, my theory is that Mahfouz won the Nobel Prize, US trade publishers rushed to get out all of his novels in English translation and settled for some subpar, and in that rush, they sort of settled for some subpar translations. And this is one that the English translation completely wipes out a lot of Sufi resonance. There is a beggar who recites poetry in Arabic. That beggar is almost completely absent from the translation, and all of the poetry that he recites is completely absent from the English translation. So that's another translation concern that people should be aware of. So even when there is an English translation of a text, you can't always take it for granted.
Yes, I guess so too. And thank you so much, Emily, for the discussion about your book. And are you kind of right now done with the detective genre, or what are you currently working on as your next project, basically?
Yes. So in writing this book about novels, I learned about myself that I just want to write about poetry now. I'm done with novels. They're too long. I've always been interested in poetry, and I think I read novels a bit like poetry. Like, as you can tell, I get into the nitty-gritty of particular words. So I have a couple of articles that I'm working on now, but in general, well, yeah, so one is about continuing about Jabra Ibrahim Jabra, who's really central to the book as well, but dealing with his early articles about British romanticism and his early translations into Arabic of British and American romantic poetry and what those translations reveal about his politics and his poetics in the 1950s and 60s. I'm also working on an article about Nazik al-Malaika, the Iraqi poet that I translated in Revolt Against the Sun, that basically argues she's doing what's called in Western criticism, practical criticism, at a time when so many other Arab critics are doing romantic criticism. So sort of like in the clouds theorizing. And I use some archival papers from her time as a scholar, a Rockefeller fellow in the US to show that she was truly influenced by this American approach to criticism. And then, yeah, the next book project, I'm hoping, it's a bit of an ambitious thing at the moment, but I'm hoping to sort of retell a history or some histories of Arabic, modern Arabic poetry, which does not confine poets to this sort of progression through neoclassical, romantic, modernist, but actually traces threads of continuity from the early 20th century to the present, looking at the subjective trend and the objective trend. So when are poets being introspective and romantic, and when are poets being political, and sort of when is poetry intended for performance and public use, and when is it intended as a sort of private engagement with emotions and feelings? And the hypothesis, I won't call it an argument, the hypothesis of this book is that those two threads persist through the 20th century. You have romanticism in the early 20th century. You even have modernism, if you want to call it that, in the early 20th century. Basically, those words are not relevant for us anymore. So like looking at the actual material of the poetry and trying to see, can we tell this history a different way than simply importing these European terms, neoclassical, romantic, modernist? So that's the goal of the next imagined book.
Thank you so much, Emily. We are now at the end of our podcast, and I wanted to thank you for our conversation and that you were here today with us. Thank you so much.
And thanks to everyone who listens to this.